My name is Nancy Heingartner. I'm the Outreach Coordinator at the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, CRECA, which is located on the second floor of this building. Welcome to today's lecture. I'm delighted to be able to introduce Mike Kuban, an old friend of mine. We met in spring 1987 at Leningrad State University when we were on a CIEE program together. So we go way back to Soviet days. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Mike. Mike Kuban is responsible for overseeing a variety of international teacher exchange programs at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. Before joining the State Department, Mr. Kuban worked for 10 years for the American Councils for International Education, a nonprofit organization that administers exchange programs for students, scholars, teachers, and professors of the United States and of the newly independent states of the former Soviet Union and Central Europe. Mr. Kuban earned a master's degree in Slavic languages and literatures from the University of Virginia and a bachelor's degree in Russian language and area studies from Dickinson College. I wanted to also just mention to you that a variety of CRECA materials, information on other CRECA programming is available at the back of the room, so pick some up on your way out. And please now join me in welcoming Mike Kuban.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to say how nice it is to be here, and I appreciate the invitation from CRECA, and I thank all of you for coming out today to hear what I have to say. As Nancy mentioned, I'm Michael Kuban of the Teacher Exchange Branch of the Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. And even though it wasn't part of my career plan when I was an undergraduate and a graduate student, I guess I didn't actually really have much of a career plan in the first place, but even though it wasn't part of my plan, I spent my entire career up to this point working on international educational exchange programs, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. As Nancy also mentioned, I worked for 10 years for a DC-based nonprofit organization, and now it's been just about 8 years since I've been at the Department of State. I feel very fortunate to have kind of stumbled into this line of work because I strongly believe in the importance of exchange programs and fostering international dialogue in helping both Americans and people from other countries learn more about the world around them. Having taken part in a few study abroad opportunities while I was in college and graduate school, I knew how differently I saw the world upon my return home, and I'm sure that those of you who've traveled overseas for any period of time can relate to what I'm saying. Exchanges help us better appreciate the similarities we all share while helping us to understand and respect the differences we have. It's not a coincidence that U.S. government-funded international educational exchange programs are funded and run through the Department of State rather than Department of Education. The Department of Education works more on domestic policy-related education programs, while exchanges through the Department of State are truly an important part of the U.S. government's public diplomacy efforts both at home and abroad. Senator William Fulbright of Arkansas and other forward-thinking leaders in the 1940s and 1950s recognized the important role that exchange programs could play in helping to prevent tragedies like World War II from occurring again in the future by increasing mutual understanding between Americans and citizens of other countries. The exchange programs that bear Senator Fulbright's name, along with many other such important programs, are administered through the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at the State Department in the Public Diplomacy section. Before I joined the State Department in 2001, I had no idea of the wide range of programs that exist in this bureau. For example, there's the Fulbright Scholarship Program for students, scholars, and secondary level teachers. There's the International Visitor Program for a variety of career professionals to take part in study visits to American colleagues in their same field of work. There are junior year abroad programs for U.S. and international university students. There are programs that bring international high school juniors to the U.S. for a year to live with a host family and attend high school here. There are a variety of sports-related exchange programs, even with countries that you might not know that we're working with, such as Iran. There are programs for Americans to study abroad to learn critical languages, such as Chinese, Arabic, Russian, Hindi, Turkish, Japanese, Urdu, Korean, Persian, and others. There are programs to bring teachers of these languages to the U.S. to teach them in U.S. schools, in some cases even at the elementary level. There are cultural programs in the arts, such as jazz concerts and art exhibits that travel to remote countries around the world, that provide a different window into America than citizens of these countries might normally see. There are programs for graduate students from developing countries to earn degrees here with the idea that they'll return home and then put back into use or to practice their training. And as an example, the president of the country of Georgia, Saakashvili, is an alumnus of one of these kinds of State Department programs, and he's really putting his training to use. There are programs, some of which are done in translation for non-English speakers, such as supplemental pedagogical training for Afghan women teachers, who continued to teach during the Taliban regime, even though that had been outlawed at the time, and they taught despite the threat of severe punishment and even death. There are programs for Russian teachers of math and science and technology to compare our teaching methods with their own. This is one of the programs that I work on, and it's one of the best opportunities that I have to use my Russian language that kind of, since 1987, it's hard to keep up without regular usage. So that's one opportunity that I enjoy having. In these cases, such as the Afghan and the Russian program, participants often give lectures and lead training sessions upon their return home to colleagues so as to more widely disseminate the information and the skills that they learned while on the program, and a variety of other programs we offer. Just to give you an idea of kind of the high-profile nature of some of these programs, in addition to Saakashvili, other alumni of various State Department-funded programs include people like Kofi Annan and Tony Blair. We have a website that's exchanges.state.gov, and if you take a look there, that'll give you a better idea of the wide range of programs that we fund and oversee. That's exchanges.state.gov. I also have a handout that I'll leave behind with Krika that has a list of nonprofit organizations that administer many of these State Department-funded programs. I just basically did a search on the internet for organizations that have some sort of Slavic connection, thinking that if those of you in the Slavic field might be more interested in those kinds of organizations as possible job opportunities after you finish programs here. As I mentioned earlier, as I was finishing graduate school, I didn't have a real understanding of all of those programs and opportunities. I just knew that I'd just returned from a Czech summer language program in Brno, Czech Republic, or technically Czechoslovakia, in summer of 1990, that had been advertised and administered by the American Councils for International Education. At the time, the organization was known as ACTR, the American Council of Teachers of Russian. They have a branch of their organization that kind of is less Russian language focused called ECCELS, which is the American Council for Collaboration in Education and Language Study. So anyway, when I returned from Brno in September 1990, I contacted American Councils to see if they had any job openings. And I'm from Maryland originally, so it was convenient that I was from there, and they're based in DC, very close by. In addition to having just completed one of their programs, a friend of mine from graduate school was working there already, so that was a helpful connection to have. And so I was fortunate to be offered a job, and I started working there in October of 1990. But just in the interest of full disclosure, I sent out a lot of other resumes that I didn't get any response to, so it's not like I just sent out one resume and quickly got a job offer. But I was very fortunate to have the offer that I got. I began working as a program assistant, focusing on exchanges with the former Soviet Union, including Czechoslovakia and Hungary, as that's American Council's area of expertise, although since that time they've really expanded their reach into a lot of different world regions in addition to just Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. In the 10 years that I worked at American Councils, I worked on a variety of programs and gradually was promoted along the way to be a manager. During that time, I worked on undergraduate and graduate programs for students from the region, programs for Russian university professors and high school teachers to come to U.S. institutions to teach or to conduct research for a year. I actually don't know that I remember sending anyone to Madison, but we sent people to a lot of universities in the region and across the country with very strong Slavic departments. Worked on English language training programs for teachers from the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary. Study abroad language programs for U.S. students to study Czech, Slovak, or Hungarian in country. These are all examples of programs that are funded by the Department of State and carried out by American Councils. Also, while I worked there, I managed a number of programs that were funded by the governments of Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan to allow their students to study in the U.S. for an academic year or even for a full undergraduate or graduate degree program. The work was really very interesting on all of these programs, as it allowed me to interact with a variety of U.S. secondary and post-secondary institutions by arranging placements of students, teachers, researchers at U.S. high schools, colleges, and universities. I also had an opportunity while I was at American Councils to use my Russian pretty regularly, and even on occasion my limited Czech, to interact with participants in formal and informal settings, and for meetings with officials from the ministries of education, individual universities, and other organizations in the countries with which we worked. I thought it was particularly gratifying to be able to meet and interact with the exchange participants both here and abroad, often in Russian. We would have pre-departure orientations for U.S. grantees going overseas, arrival orientations for international participants coming here, debriefing meetings for all of the participants, and I always enjoyed seeing how much people were changed by their exchange experience. Have a lot of you been on exchange programs? Good. So you know what I'm talking about. For example, there would be Russian students who would spend a year at an American university in Nevada or Texas who would come back to D.C. at the end of the year for their debriefing, and they'd be wearing cowboy hats and they'd have a southern accent when they spoke English. There'd be U.S. students and teachers whose outlook or career goals had changed considerably between the time they went abroad and the time they returned home. There'd be people who got married to someone from their host country, although that's, I should say for the record, that's not necessarily a goal of the programs that we administer, but sometimes it's a byproduct. There'd be students and teachers with vastly improved language ability and a deeper, more nuanced understanding of the complexities of a country and its citizens. I enjoyed the opportunity to travel on a number of occasions to Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and some of the Central Asian countries for site visits and to conduct interviews to select participants to take part in these programs. Now, of course, the work wasn't always exciting travel and success stories. There's a lot more work than you might imagine that goes into administering these kinds of exchange programs. There's the matter of announcing programs, reading applications once people submit them, interviewing and selecting participants, finding an appropriate placement for international teachers and students, sometimes calling up universities cold saying, "How'd you like a student from Russia?" Arranging paperwork for visas to come to the U.S., buying airline tickets, enrolling participants in health insurance for the duration of their program, meeting people upon arrival in Washington, conducting a welcome orientation for them, cross-cultural information about the U.S. versus the country they're coming from, monitoring participants over the course of the program to make sure they're getting the support they need and achieving the goals that we have for them in their teaching or their learning assignment, leading debriefing sessions at the end of the program, conducting an evaluation to make sure that the host sites, both in the U.S. and abroad, are doing all they can to support the participants, making sure the teachers and students get on the plane and go home safely, tracking down the few participants who remain in the program illegally after the program ends, and reporting them to the Department of Homeland Security, and other such various and sundry tasks. There's also a process whereby such nonprofit organizations, such as American Councils, prepare and submit written reports to the State Department to show that they're successfully administering the programs in question. And I used to have to write a lot of those reports when I was at American Councils. And periodically, generally every 3 to 5 years, the organizations that receive these grants from the State Department have to take part in an open competition and submit a proposal to win a grant, which basically is to win the right to continue administering the programs that they've already been administering. And it's appropriate that the system's in place because it helps ensure that there's high quality of administration of the programs, making sure that the organizations do a good job, and it kind of keeps an organization from being complacent and thinking, oh, all they have to do is send reports in and not really take time or effort to make sure that the program really is high quality itself. The downside can be, however, that sometimes the incumbent organization doesn't win the grant competition. And so on the one hand, it's good to get a new organization's fresh perspective on the way a program is administered and run. But the staff people at the first organization on the grant are used to having that grant to cover their salaries. And so if you don't win the grant competition, then suddenly you can be out of a job. And that was what happened to me in 2000 at American Councils. Funding for my programs was coming to an end, and I found that it was unfortunate at the time, but I was lucky in that when that door closed, another door opened at the State Department in the Teacher Exchange Branch, and I began working there in February 2001, and that's where I still am working. It's been interesting for me in this job to work on the other side of the grant-giving process. Nonprofit organizations such as American Councils apply for and administer grants that they receive from the Department of State with money for exchanges allocated to the Department of State each year by Congress. Now at the State Department, a large part of my role is to write grant announcements and calls for proposals, and then to read and analyze proposals that we receive, and to oversee the administration of a number of grants by the organizations that have won the various grant competitions. Basically, at State, we're a little bit more removed from the participants and from the logistics of administering exchange programs than I was at American Councils, but we still remain closely involved in the selection of participants, primarily teachers in the Teacher Exchange Branch, development of applications and policy related to the programs that we administer, orientation sessions, mid-program conferences for the teachers, as well as debriefings near the end of the programs. We work with the presidentially appointed Fulbright Scholarship Board and binational Fulbright commissions and U.S. embassies abroad to administer the Fulbright program as well as other teacher exchange programs. Since the majority of the programs I work on now are at the secondary level, I've become familiar with secondary level teaching systems, challenges and successes in the U.S. and in a number of countries abroad. There are many similarities among both the challenges and successes teachers face in the U.S. and overseas, as it turns out. This is an area that I didn't know too much about previously, so it's been very interesting for me to interact with people who have such a direct impact on the future of our country and other countries around the world, teachers. Another thing that's been new for me is that my academic background, as was in the announcement and as Nancy mentioned in the introduction, is that my background was in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And now I work on programs in those regions, but also in Western Europe, South Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa. So unfortunately, I don't have as much opportunity to speak Russian as I used to, but I've been excited to broaden my portfolio, even as I'm realizing just how much there is to learn about all these different countries. Actually, I was just reading some applications from teachers from Mexico prior to the lecture. In both positions, I can't overstate the value of being able to write clearly and succinctly, being personable and professional in interactions with officials both in the U.S. and abroad, and if possible, and if this is of interest to you, of familiarizing yourself with education systems both here and overseas. In my work now at the State Department, we oversee a variety of teacher programs, primarily at the secondary level. And one of the handouts is kind of a one-page sheet listing some of the programs that we administer in my office. The most well-known program that we administer is the Fulbright Classroom Teacher Exchange Program, which basically is a swap of classrooms for either a semester or an academic year. It also sometimes involves exchanging housing. Those can be for teachers at the elementary level, middle school, high school, and sometimes at the community college or even four-year college level, but primarily at the secondary level. And that program's been in existence since like 1946, so it's a long-standing program. We have a new Fulbright Distinguished Teacher Program for U.S. and international teachers to take part in a professional development opportunity abroad for a semester, in which they may conduct research on a pedagogical topic and arrange to teach, team teach, or observe classes in secondary schools in the host country. We have programs for established international teachers and administrators from a wide range of countries around the world to spend shorter periods from 3 weeks to 4 months in the U.S. for classroom visits, training in and sharing of educational best practices, curriculum development, incorporating technology in the classroom, followed by reciprocal visits from U.S. teachers to establish links between schools in the two countries. A number of these programs are administered by IREX. Some of you might be familiar with the International Research and Exchanges Board, a nonprofit organization similar to American Councils with whom we in the Teacher Exchange Branch have been fortunate to work for a number of years now. We also have programs for new teachers or student teachers from France, Turkey, and Greece to take part in practical teaching internships in their subject fields in U.S. secondary schools under the guidance of a U.S. mentor teacher. And they share what they learned upon their return with colleagues and students at home as they begin their teaching careers. We have programs that were begun within the last 6 or 7 years as part of President Bush's National Strategic Language Initiative, such as the Teachers of Critical Languages program, bringing teachers of Chinese, Arabic, and Russian to the U.S. At elementary and secondary schools to teach their native languages for a year. We have a series of international summer language institutes for U.S. teachers of these important languages to improve their language proficiency through study programs in China, Russia, and Egypt, and many other programs as well. Now, many people, when they think of the State Department, think first and foremost of the Foreign Service. The work that we carry out in the U.S. on these exchange programs is generally carried out by the 7,400 members of the civil service, which is about 39% of all State Department personnel totally around the world. The 11,500 Foreign Service Officers, or FSOs, represent the U.S. government at embassies around the world. As you may know, it's very selective to enter the Foreign Service. First, you must take the Foreign Service written exam, which is given a few times per year at various sites across the country. The exam focuses on your knowledge of English, U.S. government, history, geography, economics, and has a pass rate of about 10%. If you pass the written exam, then you qualify to take an oral exam, which has a similarly low pass rate, I think about 20% of that 10% who pass the written then pass the oral exam. And Foreign Service officers are the face of the U.S. government around the world. FSOs choose to specialize in one of a number of areas or cones, such as political, economics, consular, and so on. Not being a Foreign Service officer myself, I'm not such an expert on the Foreign Service, but I can tell you that their work generally involves interacting with the government of the host country on a regular basis to advance the interests of the U.S. government and to serve as a resource for and act on behalf of American citizens in the country. They may process visa applications for foreign citizens hoping to visit the U.S., provide on-the-ground support for exchange programs of the types that I've mentioned earlier, and explain U.S. government policies in the host country and around the world. A website that might be of interest to you is careers.state.gov for State Department job opportunities. Again, that's careers.state.gov. In addition, I wanted to make sure to mention the National Security Education Program called the NSEP or NSEP and its Boren Fellowship. That's B-O-R-E-N. Their website is www.borenawards.org, B-O-R-E-N awards.org. NSEP is for Area Studies Specialists to conduct research in Eurasia and other world regions and then to fulfill a service requirement of working for the U.S. government. The State Department generally has NSEP positions available, usually for 1 year. If you get into the State Department through NSEP and people know you, then you get experience in the type of work on the inside that we do at the State Department. You know people and you might have an earlier idea of when jobs are being announced and that kind of thing. So that could be helpful, foot in the door. And just in general, I recommend doing internships. Many of you probably already have had experience working in internships, but they're a great way to gain relevant work experience. They can be at nonprofit organizations. There also is a competitive State Department internship program through which people work at embassies or in civil service positions based in the U.S. Some of these positions might be unpaid, but I believe some of them are paid as well. Again, you get the benefit of work experience and you get to know people who do hiring and just have contacts inside the organization, which can be very valuable. One point I wanted to make is the application deadlines are always very far in advance of when the actual time frame is that you would want to be working. So it's important to plan way, way ahead for those internships should you be interested in applying for them. Also, the same goes for the fellowship opportunities as well. So I don't want to go on, but and so I guess I'll stop here, but I want to open it up for questions and again take the opportunity to thank Krika for the invitation and the opportunity to be here, and to thank you all for being here and for your interest in international exchange programs with the Department of State. Thank you.
Thank you. Open it up to questions, for questions.
How did you find out about the position in the State Department?
I believe it was through a friend of mine who was working there at the time, but also, in addition, I didn't know about careers to a state. Well, actually, there was no internet at the time.
Can you imagine doing a job search before the internet?
No. But now there's a wider site. And actually, I think if you go to careers.state.gov, there is a link to usajobs.gov. And so that's kind of throughout the entire government. But that's, these days, that's probably one of the best ways to go about it.
What kind of jobs are there besides the Forest Service, like here in the U.S.?
State Department or just government-wide? Or well, a lot of what the State Department does, well, in my bureau, it has to do with these exchange programs, sending Americans abroad, bringing international students, teachers, researchers, professional, you know, people, athletes, journalists, whatever, to the U.S. But then there also are a lot of other kind of geographic bureaus that work on policies, and they're less kind of involved in exchange aspects, but I guess I should have looked up more in detail a lot of the different kind of bureaus that we have and the work that they do. But mostly it's policy work and a lot of things of that nature. People I know have started out working in our exchanges bureau and then moved on to other bureaus. I mean, there's geographic bureaus, there's also bureaus such as Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and so I know that there's that bureau of the State Department that publishes the annual human rights report of various countries around the world, including the U.S. So there's just, it's such a huge organization with such a wide variety of opportunities that I think that website will really be useful and interesting.
What's the civil service? Is there an exam for the civil service of the State Department?
No.
Just apply like
that? Yeah, I mean, if anyone's applied for a government job before, then you know that it's a real big bureaucratic pain form to fill out. And sometimes I've seen people who are in a position that then a position, you know, say they were hired as a temporary employee, and then the position is being made a permanent full-time position, then they have to apply for their own job. And I've seen it happen where people don't actually make the top level of the kind of list of people who applied for the job to even be called in for an interview. So there's kind of a definite strategy to how to go about filling out those forms for government jobs. But there's, you know, because it involves a resume or a CV, and then a lot of questions about, you know, to what degree do you have experience in the following kinds of tasks that presumably you're going to be asked to do in the position. So there's definitely a strategy there. But so there's not an exam, but there's a lot of hoops and paperwork that needs to be filled out. We like our paperwork in the government.
Do many or any of the teacher exchange programs you were talking about, specifically the secondary exchange programs, deal with private schools or charter schools or alternative forms of education?
Not specifically, but we definitely encourage participation by all types of schools. So it kind of depends on where people apply from.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly the classroom swap model. But yeah, we've had people from all kinds of schools and community colleges as well, so.
Do you have any like tips for applying for the civil service jobs? Because I went to an info session on Tuesday with a Foreign Service representative, and he said that a computer kind of weeds out all the first set of resumes. So is there kind of, do you have any like suggestions or tips for?
Well, I don't know how much of a tip this will be, but one thing that I've been told is that in the announcement that they, you know, where they advertise the job, it's key to, you know, if you have an opportunity to write a personal statement or an essay, to use as many of those tag words in your essay as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, what I did, I don't think this is speaking out of turn, when I applied for the position that I got, as I think with any job application, you have to kind of brag about yourself a little bit. And it's difficult in these kinds of job applications because they ask very specific questions about, have you ever you know, instructed someone in how to do this type of task or whatever. And you kind of have to rate yourself between, I've never done this, I've done something, but kind of only in a student kind of way. I've done something a little bit on my own under someone's supervision, or I've done it myself, or I can train others in how to do a certain task. And so what I tried to do while remaining honest was to kind of think of creative ways of describing things that you had done. And just what I did for myself was kept a list of what I had in mind when I was claiming to be able to train others in how to do something. So that you legitimately had a way to say, well, you know, I did this orientation session, so in a way I'm kind of training, you know, what have you. So, you know, don't lie, obviously, but just kind of think of ways that you kind of can realistically, I guess, just portray yourself in the strongest possible light. Mm-hmm. And then the taglines from the announcement, I think, is key too.
Well, in a way, that's just an extension of, you know, the standing practice of tailor your letter to the job rather than, you know, don't send out one form
standard
letter to every
job
that you apply for. I have a question, and this may be unfair, particularly as we're recording you, but I think everyone, a lot of people are curious about what's going to happen under this new administration. Do you have any prospects? Are job prospects at state going to increase? Are the numbers going to decrease, stay the same? Any predictions for us?
I'm not sure. I know that in terms of, you know, exchange programs, that they enjoy pretty broad bipartisan support. So mm-hmm. we're hopeful that a lot of the funding will continue. We are currently under a continuing resolution, mm-hmm. which means that basically Congress couldn't agree on a budget, and so you have kind of a set amount of your previous year's funding that's available up until like March. And then by March, they're supposed to have kind of like finally agreed on a budget, and then funding is allocated from that. But so for now, we're hoping that we're going to have an increase from last year. But just in terms of job prospects, I mean, I think generally government-wide, there's been a pretty sizable number of retirements over the last 4 or 5 years. And so generally, I think there's been an expansion in job opportunities for young people in the government. And I know that the State Department has made efforts to attract young people who are entering the job market in trying to be competitive with the private sector in terms of salaries and that kind of thing. So I think definitely, I think if you, even just looking on usajobs.gov, you'll see a lot of opportunities, not just in state, but government-wide.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw a little article online a week or so ago saying the State Department, the number of Foreign Service officers is vastly depleted for whatever reason, and so they're really hoping to do a major hiring of Foreign Service officers in the near future. So
I think specifically if anyone speaks Arabic or wants to go to Iraq, pretty much can go very soon.
My name is Patty. I am from Azerbaijan. I am from the school. I have a question. From the fact that my project historical comparative analysis, Azerbaijan and America oil boom, end of 19th, beginning of the 20th century. I found a lot of newspapers of the previous century and the Discourse Historical Society. But I would be very happy if I could conduct this my research, this my topic in oil states, I mean California. Do you find that I can apply for extending for next year?
Well, what kind of program are you on currently?
I am Fulbright Scholar.
Fulbright Scholar. And you, so this is a one-year program?
It's 9 months.
Okay.
End of June. So I would pretty much to have to make interviews with people who are working out here, so in order to clarify. And also, you know, my experience with the historical society, this question shows that there are a lot of material in Texas.
Mm-hmm. You probably have a program officer who works in the Fulbright program that you're in touch with. I would talk to them. I think it probably is not unheard of for programs like that to be extended, but at the same time, I think the idea generally is to give as many people as possible an opportunity to come on programs such as Fulbright. And so if you're staying for a second year, then that means that someone else isn't having a chance to come. So I don't want to answer yes or no for sure, but talk to your program officer and they...
I guess this is kind of ambiguous, but how do you measure like the success of a study abroad program or an exchange program?
That's a good question. Well, part of grant competitions that we run, where we receive proposals and applications from different organizations to administer them, always include a section on evaluation, like how are they going to evaluate whether the program was successful and in what way. And that's one of the review criteria that we use when we, you know, we have grant panels to kind of review all of the proposals that are submitted and then make a decision about which organization should get the grant. So that definitely comes into play. But basically, organizations use a variety of tools, you know, things like questionnaires and surveys, both, you know, over the course of the program and then kind of at the end. So there can be, you know, like if it's a language program, then like a language test at the beginning of the program versus one at the end. Another example might be doing some kind of interview or, you know, survey a year or 2 years or 3 years after people have returned home, seeing how they're using what they've learned on the program in their career. Occasionally we'll have an alumni conference where we'll bring together a lot of people. Like I went to an alumni conference of this program in Turkey that I administer, where you have people who, some people just began teaching and some have been teaching for 5 years. And so to kind of get a sense of how they've incorporated the classroom techniques they've learned in the U.S. in their schools in Turkey. So depending on the program, but variety of different ways. So, but I mean, that's very important, obviously, because you don't want to be giving money to something that doesn't have some means of tracking improvement in the participants or change of outlook or change of viewpoint. So,
I did a critical language fellowship.
Excellent.
And I was wondering if I were to apply for a Fulbright, does it make sense to, like, how does Fulbright, do they have any language regulations? Like, if you've studied a language already, is better to apply for somewhere else? Or is it better to apply for the language that you've studied?
So what was your language in?
Bangla, Bengali.
Cool. And so you're saying, would it be better to apply to India or Bangladesh as opposed to some other country?
Yeah.
My inclination would be apply to wherever you want to apply.
Okay.
I don't think that it would, you know, prejudice the committee that they would only send you, you know, to one of those two countries.
Okay.
But are you asking because you'd like to go back there or you'd like to go somewhere else?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure.
I mean, I know that with Fulbright, there's sometimes our regulations, as I mentioned to you, we want to give as many people as possible the opportunity to take part in programs. And so I know that Fulbright has a regulation that if you're on a program longer than like 2 months, then there's a waiting period between your first Fulbright program and the next one you can be eligible to apply for. But since your critical language program is not a Fulbright program, there might not be the same kind of limitation. Good luck at school.
Do most people in the civil service, can they speak a foreign language?
It's not a requirement, but a lot of people do. A lot of people have some kind of international interest or background that kind of draws them to that line of work in the first place, I think. So that was why I think I felt like it was so, I was so fortunate to just kind of stumble into it, because I didn't really have a plan of like, exchange programs or a career that I want to get into, but just kind of once I saw, well, I mean, knowing firsthand how much they changed my outlook on things, it was just kind of a really interesting outgrowth of my own experience. And there's not a requirement for people to know a language, but just kind of I think that people who see the value in international exchanges might be drawn to that kind of work in the first place.
Obviously, the advantage of exchange programs is that you get to go to the other country and experience the culture, but what about online and distance learning programs? Are those funded by the state, or are they really popular in the global setting?
Definitely. Some of the programs that we fund and others that we kind of, you know, develop, you know, because occasionally, you know, there'll be a request from, you know, either government or a high-ranking person in the department to develop a program with a particular country with a particular theme. Like, for example, the program with the women in Afghanistan, kind of once the Taliban fell, that was something that we were kind of tasked with putting together. So we have had some online programs and things that we've funded. That said, we also have to be kind of cognizant of the fact that not every place in the world obviously has reliable internet access. So on the one hand, yes, there's a lot of, it's an inexpensive way to transmit a lot of information great distances, but you also have to kind of take into account the difficulties associated with that. So short answer though, yes, we fund programs like that and we see them as valuable also.
I'm not sure what relevant, but what kind of jobs would you suggest to look for in case, like, I'm a native speaker, you know, of Russian, for example? Within the government and State Department, is there something that's more kind of, like, required to have language skills than others?
Well, I know there are jobs, and actually they might be run through, one thing that occurs to me is, like, Voice of America, but that's not exactly, I mean, there would be Russian jobs there, but there are other kind of jobs I would imagine that have to do with kind of escort interpreting, like we have groups that come over, as I mentioned, we sometimes have groups that don't speak English, and so that might be something that like that website would kind of steer you a certain direction, or careers.state.gov, and particularly as a language speaker of Russian, State Department might be a better fit than some other departments, but there are international divisions in a lot of other departments as well of government. So, so maybe a broader search is a good idea. But that might be something that paired with a background in business or something like that, then there could be more high level negotiating kind of jobs available. But that kind of thing would require a whole lot of training, from what I would imagine, but yeah, I mean, just kind of the short, easy answer is kind of escort interpreting and kind of programs that work with participants who don't speak a lot of English. Although, to be fair, like I don't know that you necessarily need a foreign language to work on programs with people who don't speak English, because there are these interpreters who do the interpretation for you. So. We have people from, all over the place who come for short-term and longer-term programs that are, provided with interpreters. So, I mean, that interpreting, as I said, like escort interpreter might be an option too. So, depends on kind of what your interests are beyond speaking the language. But there definitely ought to be some opportunities, I would think.
Once you join the government, in any agency, any branch, do they offer continuing education in, like, in a different country, host country? Is that an option?
I would guess that would depend on the department and on the policies of your individual office, because if you have a full-time job, then you'd have to kind of get permission from your supervisor to be away for an extended period. One thing that I know is possible, a friend of mine in my bureau is a Russian speaker, and there are positions that are generally filled by Foreign Service officers and embassies abroad, and sometimes they can't fill them for whatever reason, and they call them hard-to-fill positions. And so she worked for a year as the cultural affairs officer at the embassy in Almaty, Kazakhstan. And so she had worked that out with her supervisor that, a job, not necessarily her same job, but a job like would be there for her when she came back after that year abroad. And it's a way to get great experience on that side of things, about seeing all the work that they do. So that's not exactly what you're asking, but that's a means to have that kind of training. And I can't speak for other branches of government, but the State Department's very big on providing training courses, for like a week at a time or a few days at a time at a training center near DC, in all kinds of fields. I mean, they have language classes in a variety of languages. There are programs on leadership training. Working with managers more effectively, these kinds of things. So all kinds of training happen. Because, I mean, this training where they train, they have courses for civil service employees, also is for Foreign Service officers, too. So lots of people take training there. So,
Do most of the people in the State Department have master's degrees?
I don't have a statistic, but I would say that a fair number do, but a fair number also don't. So I don't think it's a prerequisite necessarily.
What if you do get in and start working? Is government like sponsoring an education though, if you want to get a master's?
Again, I think that probably would depend on your department and on your bureau, but generally they really encourage, more than at my nonprofit job, they really are big encouragers of all kinds of training. So I don't want to give a blanket yes or no, but I would imagine that would be something that, you know, government organizations would want to support you in. Because, I mean, you know, they see the importance of additional knowledge and training in their employees, so.
What kind of experience do you think ACTR is looking for in program assistants?
As I mentioned, they now work in a lot more regions of the world than just Russia and that part of the world. But that still is kind of the heart and soul of the president of the organization and a lot of the senior people there. So I think having much of a Russian background is a good kind of entree there. But basically just, and particularly if you've been on one of their programs, that's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. But I got that job having been, even though I had been on this summer program in the Czech Republic, I went with Nancy on a rival program to the Soviet Union at the time. So I was glad that didn't kind of get held against me when the hiring time came. But there are people there who don't speak Russian. But I think that's the main thing. And just being able to express yourself clearly in writing. I mean, writing is key anymore, no matter what job you're trying to have. But, good interview skills and, you know, professional and all that kind of thing. So, but I think, you know, with an enthusiasm, for exchanges and as I say, if you have been on, even if it's not one of their exchange programs, just kind of talking about your exchange experience is a good thing for them. Now, it may be the kind of thing where if they lost a grant or something, then they might be in a period where they're not hiring as many people. But on the handout that has a list of various nonprofit organizations, there's tons of places that might be worth looking into. Because even if one place didn't get a grant, someone got it, you know. So if not one place, then keep trying.
Any more questions? Well, thank you all for attending today, and thanks again for coming, Mike.
Thank you all.